Alrighty. Couple technical difficulties there, but hopefully all resolved. So the get right into it tonight. As advertised, we're going to be one of the requests I got was to introduce the subject of realism. Let me just look on my page and see if it's showing up. Kind of, sort of. Yeah, good enough. Anyway, realism. But why through the lens of Augustine? Well, here's my basic reason. I don't believe in reinventing the wheel. And right now, one of the two classes I'm taking at PRTS is on Augustine. And I'd be writing a paper specifically on the realism of Augustine and his taking Plato's idea, correcting some things and inheriting other things. And I just thought, well, I'll take a lot of the questions I've been getting and filter it through the lens of Augustine's realism. I think that's a valuable thing to do because I think it's a very profound idea. And we'll relate it to a lot of things that are actually relevant, although we've got to do some grammar first. So you won't see as much practical application today, but we have to make it simple. And we have to make it concise as well. So, first things first, I'm not going to go into a big biography of Augustine. I would assume that if you're the kind of person that he would find this even remotely interesting, you already know who Augustine was. You know, when he lived in the his younger days in the 4th century, and really most of his as Bishop of Hippo in Northern Africa, that he did a lot of his arguments against groups like the Manichaeans and the Donatists and the Pelagians, and then of course his most famous work, The City of God, very relevant, becoming more relevant every day. And we'll get a chance, Lord willing, to cover some of those subjects. But if I'm going to set all of that in a cast of realism, I've got to explain what that means first to those of you that don't know. Realism is, from the word, well, let's just do the etymology of it first, the breakdown or the competition of the two main schools, realism versus nominalism. And realism, and again, we're not going to be talking about, that's going to run right off the board, isn't it? Well, whatever. It'll go as far as it, I'll try to keep everything over there. But at any rate, this comes from the Latin word res, which means thing. And nominalism comes from the Latin word nomen, which means name. What's that got to do with anything? Well, the whole debate is about something called a universal. That's more grammar that we have to introduce. A universal is essentially something like goodness, beauty, justice, truth, even oneness. As I like to say, over-there-ness or anything else-ness. And we'll see why that is and why it's that expansive in just a little bit. And so the debate was, how is it that the human mind unifies the diverse amount of things that we see in the world? How is it that we can make sense of things? How is it that our words have any meaning? And realists were saying that those things had to be things, that if the adjectives that we ascribe to so many things, just or beautiful or good or whatever, or bad, conversely, if those are real things, then these have to be in some sense abiding over all of them, eternal, unchanging, immaterial, invisible, but nevertheless real entities. Nominalists, and by the way, this, you know, debate with these names, it doesn't show up until the Middle Ages. But the nominalists would say, no, those are just names that we give to things to, you know, to make sense of it. And they're convenient labels. Now I'm broad brushing everything. In fact, there's another view, conceptualism. And there's shades within realism and within these different views. So again, all we're doing here is ABCs here, just to introduce the idea. But in order to really get a sense of it, I think we have to travel back in time, even further back behind Augustine, all the way to the early 4th century BC, to Plato. And Plato and Aristotle, and we won't cover Aristotle's as much. We'll mention a few things about him, but Plato mostly because Augustine really, at least more explicitly, takes his view. Let me just erase this right away. I won't make that mistake I did the other night. I'll make other mistakes. Tau. Lost my eraser. That's how things are going. But so a little Plato 101 in order to get Aristotle 101. Plato called these universals, he didn't use that word, that comes much later. Plato called these forms. And he even held that they existed in a realm of forms. I'm just going to draw a line just to make it nice and, simple to understand. Plato, above this line, is going to call these things forms. Now, some synonyms we can use. He used one, ideas. I don't like that at first because for us that's very subjective, but that's kind of the word he used. And really what we're getting at, though, is the difference between, I'll try to color code here so we don't get too mixed up. Just take that one that we already mentioned, justice. Okay, this is the essence of justice, right? And then there's going to be down here what we're going to call instances or examples of justice. For example, a just war. By contrast, an unjust war. Maybe a just ruling. Hey, social justice, there's one. We can throw that in there. And anything else you want to put in there? How do you tell the difference between a just one and an unjust one? A just law and an unjust law, or a ruling, or a war, or an action being virtuous? How do you do that? And Plato explored that through his many dialogues, where Socrates was sort of the main protagonist. And he had this, to me, the easiest one to explain this by, at least I found it to be the case over the years, is the dialogue, the Euthyphro, which the setting is, and it's another reason why it's easier to explain, is that a lot of people are familiar with the Apology or those dialogues that are right around the Apology. And the Apology is basically Socrates' defense before the Athenian Council, where he's being tried for impiety and introducing or disbelieving the gods of the city and so on. And so as Socrates is waiting for his trial, this younger know-it-all, Euthyphro, comes up to him. They run into each other, and they're at the stairs, I guess, of the Athenian courthouse. Bump into each other. Hey, what are you doing here? Socrates, well, I'm being tried and put to death if I'm found guilty. What are you doing? And Euthyphro tells him that he's here to argue a case. He's here to prosecute his own father for beating to death the household slave. And Socrates is saying, "Wow, that's pretty impressive. You're gonna try your father for murder? How do you know what you're doing is just?" And that begins their conversation. And what happens in the course of that dialogue is that Socrates presses him for a definition of justice. In other words, for the essence of justice. And in fact, I'm glad I put four X's there, because really what happens is that Euthyphro answers him in four ways. Each way turns out to be insufficient, and Socrates shows him why. For example, Euthyphro's first answer is, "Well, what I'm doing right now is just." Duh. I mean, anybody can see that. And Socrates' answer is, "Okay, that's interesting. It may be true, or it may not, but I think you've told me what justice does. But I'm asking you what justice is." And so he says, "What I'm doing. I'm doing justice. Not that large amounts of people in our day need to be corrected on that simply by uttering the notion of justice, that therefore it makes it justice." Well, it may be and it may not. But you're At this point, you're just telling me what justice does at best. But I'm asking, what's the essence of justice? What's the form of it that makes these either more or less just? And so that didn't cut it. Euthyphro didn't answer his question. And so goes back to the drawing board and says, well, it's what the gods love. They're Greek, so it's polytheism. What the gods love or approve. And he changes the word at that point, says that is what is pious. He uses the word pious. So treat them as synonyms, at least at this point, piety and justice. And Socrates says, well, that sounds pretty good at first until you realize that the gods are a mess. Have you read any of the myths? It's like a never-ending episode of Cops. I mean, they're binding each other up, they're having affairs, they're doing all these things. And Euthyphro finally says, okay, you got me there. But it's what all the gods love. So on this, there's no disagreement at all. It's what they all agree with. All the gods say check to that one. And that creates an even bigger problem. In fact, this becomes a very famous, principle, I guess you could say, in the history of philosophy. And this is where we get, if you ever heard the Euthyphro dilemma, because then Socrates asks him, he says, well, let's assume that's true. I'm not so sure it is, but let's assume it's true for a second. It's what all the gods love. Well, let me ask you this. Do all the gods love what is just and pious because it is just and pious, or is it just and pious because the gods love it? In other words, is what is right, right because God says so, or is it really right independent of him? By the way, if you know the biblical answer out of that dilemma, you'll realize, and you already know, it's not a dilemma for rational monotheism. It's only a dilemma because they're polytheists. Or if you are not a polytheist and you believe in one God, and yet you still find it to be a dilemma, that may be because you have a sub-biblical, not quite rational view of God, that he has to reach outside of himself for some standard of justice, or that it is by fiat, but then therefore by his will, not according to his nature. What's the answer though, class? The answer is what is just is what he says, which is in accordance with his nature, his whole being. All that is in God is God, and that goes for his justice as well. So that's a dilemma for Euthyphro, though. Here's what he does finally. He says, well, I think what is pious, and he divides it up. He says, what is pious, that has to do with the care of the gods. And everything that's left over in what is due to men is justice. So it's just the leftovers. He just divides it. What did he do? He just divided his non-answer, which makes two halves of no answer, right? And so Socrates calls him on it. And finally, Euthyphro's like, okay, whatever. I gotta go kill my father now, do justice. You go on your way. Stop bugging me. And of course, Socrates is very disappointed, and that's how it all ends. And everybody dies. The father and Socrates. So you should probably get this right. You should probably have a better answer than Euthyphro did. What's that got to do with universals, and what's that got to do with Augustine? Well, Plato is showing us through Socrates' dialogue, and this process, we call it abstract reasoning. Plato called it dialectical reasoning, and he didn't mean the same thing Hegel would by the dialectic. But you're abstracting from these things in the world, and just showing the insufficiency of any of these reference points down here. What he's saying is there has to be some immaterial, yes, invisible, but eternal, immutable objects. One of the ways to mess this up, and I even see some dictionaries of philosophy do this, is that they'll divide the different views of, where do I have it? Do I have one in here? I copied an example of this today and I don't like it. Well, I'll get to that in a second. I'll get to that after I explain what nominalism is, because it breaks down the views and it does in a way that's okay. It's kind of accurate, but it treats this as pink unicorns again. And that's not what Plato was saying. He's saying the exact opposite. I like to say pink unicorn. It's like my it's my symbol for everything that's abstract in that sense. People misuse that word too. But hopefully you get the idea here, is you have the essence of things. By the way, same thing with good, beautiful, truth, all those things. If our words are going to make sense, all the predicates we use all the time for any particular thing, whether it's an action, that's a moral action, or whether it's a thing, anything, in science is going to require realism. This isn't just about morality. Everything is going to require that there is an essence of the way things are. You say, well, why does that have to be up here, Plato? Well, that brings in Aristotle's view. Aristotle actually leveled two criticisms against his teacher slash mentor, master. Aristotle, of course, came right after Plato. He was a student of Plato and became his most famous student. And Aristotle leveled two criticisms against Plato, main criticisms, against, at least against his view of the forms. Number one, Plato, all you did was move the problem of, it's called the one and the many, the problem of the one and the many, right? There's these diverse things in the world. How do we divide them up into classes and call a bunch of things one thing, right? Okay, the problem of the one and the many. And so Aristotle would say, all you did is move that problem upstairs. Now, what does he mean by that? Because if you're a Plato fan, you might say, no, he didn't. He solved it. In Book Six of the Republic, he made the good, like the sun of the solar system. The good. It's like the form of all forms, and all the other ones are kind of revolving. I'm using modern astronomy for this. Plato didn't actually do it like this, but I find it to be a very helpful way to explain it. Where the good is kind of like the sun. It's not only the light, the illuminating light, but it's sort of the center of gravity. And all the other forms revolve around that. Well, that's kind of arbitrary. In fact, in one of Plato's other dialogues, the Timaeus, he has his sort of creation myth, right? His god, the Demiurgos, which Gnosticism eventually picked up on. But that God created the world by looking outside of himself to some blueprint of these archetypes or these forms or ideas. And he made the world based on these eternal attributes. And you're like, right over his, and he just missed it. He didn't just miss it, but that's sort of a clue as to how Augustine's going to fix all this. And but Aristotle would say, that didn't solve anything. You haven't given any reason why these are all united as one, right? As one essence, or to what orchestrates them? What makes them one instead of parts and at war with each other, just like those gods were at war with each other. Okay, that's number one. His second criticism that he leveled is you haven't given us any account, you haven't given any sufficient reason as to how this realm causes this realm, how what Plato called the realm of the forms, and he would call it the real world versus the mere appearances. But how does this world even come about, especially if this world is the most perfect world? And the good life, the life of the philosopher, is to contemplate this world by the most excellent part of us, the intellect. How does this cause this? Okay, so here's what Aristotle does to fix all this in his mind. And this has problems too. But it gets us closer to the finished product of realism. So Aristotle, I'm gonna have to erase this. Guess I'll leave the line there for when we get to Augustine. But Aristotle did this. He said there still is an eternal essence of things, the way things are. By the way, another name for this later on in the history, in recent years, really, is essentialism, because the essence of things is what it is. It's basically, it's the metaphysic that explains objective truth. And so Aristotle would say, yes, everything has a, I don't know, a form, but every form is never without its matter. That's what that is. So composites of form and matter. And Aristotle would say beyond that, these forms are extramental. That is, they are objects outside of us. Now, this is a misunderstanding of Plato, as some historians of philosophy would, you know, that that these are not objects. Now, Plato is saying these are objects. These are not non-things. These are things. That's his whole point. That these are actually more like things. It's not even, that's not even strong enough. These are the real things. Down here is just appearances. So, you know, when you see dictionaries of philosophy do that, that's, I'm not asking you to agree with Plato, because I don't either, but at least get his view right. But that's Aristotle down there fixing that. And that shows up in Thomas Aquinas. Aquinas, by the way, doesn't simply take Aristotle, and he you know, read Ed Fazer on that. There's a Thomistic view that's really, it avoids all the problems of both the Platonic and the Aristotelian view. But anyway, in Aristotle's view, you know, you have all those different things. We're going to skip past that because we're trying to get to Augustine. And it's just the easiest way to introduce that is to show how in the biblical view, and I'm going to throw two verses at you that I've already thrown at you, and that is Psalm 19, 1 and 2 and Romans 1, 20. Notice that those are passages about general revelation. Notice that those are passages about natural theology. And so, well, man, what are they doing here again with realism? Well, you're going to see a synergy between those things. But the upshot to objective truth, so both Plato's view and Aristotle's view, is the view that laid the foundation for objective truth in the West. Meaning, this thing, this object, whatever it is, let's say it's a tree. That's a tree. Here's me, I guess. Here's a mind. It doesn't matter who it is. This is the subject. He is looking at this, which is the object, right? And so you've heard the expressions, truth is subjective versus truth is objective. What do those two mean? Well, on the most obvious, basic, and correct level, truth is subjective. That statement would mean that truth is in the eye of the beholder, or something like that, or it's all in how you look at it. It's each person's perspective. Everyone has your own truth, that kind of a thing. Whatever you see, right, or your angle on it. If I say truth is objective, I mean that the way that is of it, if there are six people in this room, then that reality does not depend on any finite mind's perspective, right? And so this is the foundation to objective truth. By the way, how is the word objective being used in the past 30 years and in the last 10 to 15 years on Hyperjet, especially in church material on any subject? Objective is being used as another form of subjectivity. How many times have you heard in the last 20 years? And they did not use this language before our generation and the generation before it. How many times have you heard now things like this? Well, no one has an objective perspective on that, whatever it is. What do they mean? Well, they mean something. They mean an exhaustive perspective, a privileged perspective. You get the idea? Exhaustive or privileged. Did you catch it? They're using this word to mean another brand of that, just the most arrogant version of that, okay? You can use the word in that way if you specify your terms. The problem is that the two concepts have bled together over the past 20 years to such an extent that this actually has to be recovered. That the notion of objective truth, of reality being what it is, no matter what you feel about it, no matter how many people vote to the contrary, that there is a nature of things outside of us, and it is what it is. And that's what Plato and Aristotle would agree upon, in spite of the differences of where they located everything. Okay, so that's an important point to make. Now, in contrast again to all this is the idea of nominalism. It came much later. And because we're just going to fast forward to Augustine, I won't get into it. But with nominalism, if justice is just a word, if there's no such thing as justice, and by the way, the modern world has come up with supposedly new ways to come to the same end without, you wouldn't think of them as nominalist. But, you know, Hume's empiricism that led to skepticism, Locke's original empiricism, Marx's Marxism, a positivist positivism, they're all forms of nominalism. They're all differently motivated ways to achieve some other reality on the cheap by something down here, whether it's empirical observation or by some bloody revolution. But whatever it is, they are positing realities out of thin air. And it's, and, you know, when you define what nominalism is, it's kind of funny. You can't even finish your sentence, which is what it does. When you say nominalism is the belief that universals are just words we give to. How do I finish the sentence? Because if I'm a nominalist, I don't believe in predicates. Now, you got to get technical to see how I got from here to there. But that's the idea. In the Middle Ages, after Augustine, with the rise of the scholastic method and with the rise of the Christian invention of the university, by the way, university comes from the words for unity and diversity. It comes from realism. It comes not just from Western philosophy and the belief in objective truth, but with the realist metaphysic that, that undergirded that objective truth. The whole premise of the university was that there was one universe of knowledge, and all of the other subjects were things. And so, for example, when they said that theology is the queen of all sciences and philosophy is her handmaiden, well, philosophy is not much of a handmaiden if it doesn't hold the fortress and hold the ground for realism. The scholastics in the Middle Ages believed that. They believed that if realism lost, objective classical theology would be lost with it. That's what happened, and the rest happened. Fast-forwarding too much. Let's go back to Augustine. Let's go one-on-one. Let's see how he envisioned this. He took this not directly from Plato, but from the Neoplatonists that were closer to his time. And of course, Augustine wasn't always a Christian. He converted in 387. He wanted to be a master of rhetoric. He went up to Milan and Rome to teach. And in Milan, he was converted under the preaching of Ambrose. And he wanted to be a Christian philosopher, a Catholic philosopher, and be the great Christian thinker. And in the process, he was still holding on to Neoplatonic ideas and arguing against a school that we'll get into called the Manichaeans. And see how they're relevant. But then he got called to be a bishop. And one of the early books he wrote, of course, was the Confessions, one of the most famous ones. But he takes this Neoplatonic foundation. And it's fine, and, you know, in the Confessions, there's this constant refrain. There's this one particular book, and I can't remember which book it was, book 5 through 7, somewhere in there, where he compares the Neoplatonic view to the biblical view, and especially about Christ. And he says, you know, among the Platonists, I see this confirmation with the biblical view. I see this confirmation with Moses. I see this confirmation with Paul. I see this synergy. On the other hand, this is nowhere in the Platonists. And he would keep doing that. He would make those comparisons and show what was similar and then show what was superior in the Christian view. And that's ultimately what he does to realism. So he agrees with, for example, the greatest of the Neoplatonists, Plotinus, right before his time. He agrees with him that there has to be one supreme ultimate being, whatever you want to call it. The Neoplatonists called it the One, that had to unify all of intellectual reality. This one being had to be simple and eternal and immutable for reasons that they proved in the course of their arguments. And the forms or the ideas that we talked about, and this is an advance that the Neoplatonists made from Plato, these ideas or forms had to be inside the divine mind. And so that part of it, they made an advance on Plato. They held that the essence of things had to be inside the divine mind. Okay, so far so good. But then Augustine showed many, many things that the Neoplatonists were wrong about. And it was not just, well, that's not in the Bible, that's unbiblical. But it's also irrational. It won't work. It's actually not as intellectually satisfying as their people might like to argue. And so this one couldn't be merely impersonal, or the idea that at least you couldn't know him personally. The Neoplatonists had basically a doctrine of, how did they explain what Plato couldn't? How did it cause everything? Well, they had a doctrine. This is not the best drawing, but it's called emanations. I don't know why I do this, but I do. Why do they do this? Well, one reason they did it is because if the supreme being is perfect, then how could he directly create this kind of a world? And of course, you can see how that led to Gnosticism, because, of course, the Gnostics didn't believe that a good God could have created a world that was evil or contained evil. And so that's part of what they did. And so they believed a lot in this. Augustine's going to reject this entirely. Sometimes, by the way, you'll hear, the great chain of being from a Christian perspective. And all it's doing is showing a hierarchy among beings. It's not embracing this, but you'll hear it talked about as if it's the same thing as Neoplatonism or the analogy of being. Critics of that want to link that to this and say, you see, you wind up with pantheism. I've heard those criticisms of Augustine and Aquinas by certain authors, and they're just misunderstanding the concept. Now, why are they misunderstanding it? Well, the main reason they're misunderstanding is because Augustine drew a really sharp line between himself and the Neoplatonists at this idea of creation. And in fact, I'm not even going to keep this on the board because Augustine would not hold to this idea of this lifeless sort of static one. Okay, so he disagreed here. And one more thing that's different is that the Neoplatonists, like Plato, believe that you came in contact with this one through through that dialectical process. And so the philosopher, the thinker, had direct insight into the nature of these forms, which, if that's true, it has direct insight into the nature of God. Augustine said no. Instead, he opted for something that was called divine illumination, so that God communicated himself both through nature and through scripture. So there was that kind of a medium, which we can come back to that. We've already indicated that with natural theology. But here's the finished product. So let's wrap it up with this. It's just this grammar stage tonight, and then we'll start applying it to his doctrine of scripture and different other doctrine of God and so forth. The finished product here, the upshot, is that universals in an Augustinian realism are two things. If I can get the marker open. They're attributes of God. Let's put the word divine here. Divine attributes and divine ideas. And so he'll retain the idea of ideas, but those are ideas, and even the ideas in the eternal decree are founded upon the divine attributes. Now, let me give you a why is that, and let me give you a where to look. Where to look is Psalm 19, 1 and 2. Think about that for a second. The heavens declare the what? The glory of God. What does that mean? Just sort of a, cliche. That's just something we say, rah, rah. Or is that actually talking about excellencies or perfection, specific glory? When I look at things in nature, I see specific things about God. And that's what Paul's saying in Romans 1:20. And so when God creates, and here's the why, when God creates the world, on what basis can God create the world? Remember what Plato did. Plato was not wrong to think that God had to base his idea of creation on the divine. Plato was wrong in thinking that the divine had to go outside of itself for this blueprint or these archetypes. No, the archetypes were inside of him. By the way, that word that shows up again when the reformers deal with this very thing and divide theological knowledge into archetypal and ectypal knowledge of God. And Turretin uses that word archetypal to refer to universals, almost in a footnote in his Institutes. But at any rate, this is what you would have with an Augustinian, and these collapse on themselves. They're not two different things. This is what's called a logical distinction and not a real distinction. So again, all that is in God is God. God is simple, so that the divine ideas are of himself and the whole of himself. Again, we're creatures. We can't do that. We have to think in terms of discursive reasoning. We have subject and predicate. The only way we can map things out is in that complex way, compound way, it would be a good way to say it. Okay. And so this is what you have with Augustinian realism. It's like Augustine took Plato and he didn't baptize him in Christianese, just like Aquinas didn't take Aristotle and baptize him in Christianese. No, Augustine corrected Plato. And very, you know, he took Paul seriously and you know, looted the Egyptians, so to speak, which is, by the way, a piece of imagery that Augustine himself used in On Christian Doctrine, for one. I think he might have used it in the City of God as well. But anyway, you have this beauty, goodness, justice. As I was going through that, what went into your mind? You thought to yourself, well, silly Plato, those are just attributes of God. Exactly. Exactly. Okay, and divine ideas. And so we looked at Romans 1:20 already. Implications, practical application. For a couple of things in realism. So are you familiar with the term nominal Christian? Nominal Christian. What is a nominal Christian? A nominal Christian is one that is just so in name. Okay? So it's nominalism applied to your profession, you might say. Okay? What other areas of life is this relevant in? How about choose your own identity? How about the however many genders there are now? Does that have anything to do with this? Yes, it does. Your view of science, your view of history, your view of texts, all the things we deal with, that's just your interpretation, that kind of thing. What that is a loss of realism playing out in all the different areas of life. And what do I have here? Natural theology. This is, if you haven't noticed it yet, this idea is going to issue forth into what we talked about, natural theology and natural law. So basically these universals, what does Paul say? The invisible things of God are clearly perceived through the things that have been made, divine things through natural things. Let me say it again, divine things through natural things. What kind of natural things? Well, in Romans 1:20, descriptively, there are things about God. Descriptively. Well, the descriptive realm. In other words, science, history, theology. I see things. I see nature. Personhood. What's a person? Okay? That's an object with a nature. You don't get to make it whatever you want to. And that object is reflecting attributes of God. And then Romans 2, normatively, in natural law. Okay, so Romans 1:20, Romans 2:14 and 15. When God has requirements that he has written not merely in the Ten Commandments, but the same essence of those same requirements are written on the heart of even the Gentiles from the beginning, those are things that speak about God. When courage is called for, or if humility is called for in a particular moral sphere or occasion, that is saying something about God. Easy example, Ephesians 5. Husbands, love your wives as Christ loved the church and gave himself up for her. Self-sacrifice of a husband is what it is because of what it says about Christ in the gospel. Christ did that. Everything you're commanded to do because of what it says about God. Everything in the world of science or history or gender or anything else is what it is because of what it says about God. That's realism. That's the metaphysic of the Bible. And Augustine was profound at drawing that out in all the areas of life. So here's what we're going to do, Lord willing. We're going to pick this up at his view of Scripture first. We'll look at his book on Christian doctrine. Then we'll go to his doctrine of God. We'll see that in the City of God and on his book on the Trinity. Then we'll look at his view of good and evil, both the origin and the nature of evil, and we'll look at his writings against the Manichaeans on that. Then we'll look at his view of salvation. We'll look at his anti-Pelagian writings, and I'll apply realism there. Then we'll look at his view of the church as he argues against the Donatist, and we'll see how he brings unity to the diversity of things there. And then finally, we'll look at his City of God, which is incredibly relevant for our day today, and we'll see how the City of God was the fulfillment, the better fulfillment with corrections completed in there. Not only of Plato's Book Six of the Republic, it straightens that mess out, but even of the pagan Republic. And we'll see an ideal reign that is more real, not less real, than the progression of the kingdom of Christ in history. And we'll see how that defines pretty much every area of life. So I'll cut it there and try to get on at least one more time this week.